Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Yang kinshi samudaya dhammang sabantang nirodha dhammanti. So that phrase was not premeditated. Just I thought of that just a second before I chanted it. That maybe it's because we've just been chanting the Ratana Sutta, which is the qualities of an Aryan, a stream winner, and it's also the way a stream winner is described, Yankinchi Samudaya Dhammang Sabantang Nirodha Dhammanti. That all the dhammas which have an origin, a cause, those dhammas also have an end, a cessation. It's one of the great insights which sound very easy, but which is very deep and very profound, so profound that it changes the course of one's life and takes one into being someone who is leaving the world rather than someone who is getting more entangled in the world. And one of the ways of describing this is just the fact that our way of looking at things, our thoughts, our views, our perceptions are very much sort of distorted. This is what we call like avijja, delusion. And it's so tough to overcome that delusion. And in order to explain what you mean, there's so many similes which either the Buddha taught or monks make up over the years. And I remember even my predecessor, Ajahn Jakaro, once being with him and giving him this was years ago in Thailand, and he gave this beautiful simile. Maybe it was the time, the place, or just the way he put it. And they're just like a person in a dark room. And they've lived in that dark room for such a long time, they just can't see anything. And then someone opens a window one day and gets the light in, and now you can see things. Same it may be in your hut when you close the shutters, and it may be the sun might have come up, but because the shutters are very tight, you don't know what's out, you know, even what's in the room, because you can't see very clearly. There's no light, maybe the light's not working, or the days before you had the solar-powered lighting. And you can't see what's in the room, but then, you know, you open up the windows and the light streams in, and you can actually see where you are and see the situation in which one is in. And that's like understanding the Dhamma, contemplating it. The simile which I preferred was the simile of the person who was born in a prison, raised in a prison, lived all their life in a prison. And just they just don't know what prison is. You can't know what prison is, because that's just what you're used to. And there comes the day when you're released. I was mentioning this to someone, I think, today or earlier, that sometimes when you're released from prison, sometimes prisoners don't want to go because they've been in that jail for such a long time. They're used to it and they find comfort there. And it's a transition from being in prison to being out of prison, which is a difficulty. But once that transition is made, as everybody would know, there's far more freedom, far more happiness, far more peace, far more contentment outside than in the jail. But it's making the transition is a difficulty. But it's also, before you can even make that transition, is to realize that one is in a jail. And too often that people's perceptions are just totally skewed. And because we're totally skewed, we don't know really what we are. We don't know really what we're doing. And just pain and suffering keep coming up again and again and again. And part of the job of Buddhism or Dhamma is actually getting a clearer perspective on the situation one's in, why these things happen, and exactly what's really going on in this life. The trouble is that people don't challenge enough to actually to get the clear perspective. First of all, most people's perspective is just built upon their thinking. And we think too much and we argue so much, and we try and use the reason and the logic to try and figure things out. But unfortunately, the reason and the logic, the thinking mind, as many of you have been there long enough, old enough, thought long enough, to know that the thinking doesn't get you anywhere. Too often in my life, my thinking has let me down. The thinking has seemed to sort of provide some sort of truth and some sort of answer. But later on I found, no, that I was totally wrong. How many times have you thought yourself to a conclusion and found later on it was mistaken? And that happens so often that these days, I'm a monk of enough years now, I just don't trust my thinking. You use it, employ it, especially to give a talk like this, but you don't trust it one moment. It makes too many mistakes. And that thinking is one of what the Buddha called papancha, the proliferation. And it's amazing just how the mind can proliferate from one thought leading to another thought, to creating fantasies, dreams and scenarios. And when one gets really sucked into that thinking world, it can make you get angry at your friends. It can make you fall in love with your enemies. It can sort of control you so much that these days when I look at my thinking, I see it more as an enemy than I ever saw before. You can see how it completely can deceive me. And it's true that, you know, there's some really wonderful people. And sometimes, why do we get angry at these people? And sometimes you get some stupid people, and why do we love them and think they're so wonderful? The thinking is just so delusive. So if you can just stand back and get a perspective on your thinking mind, then you won't trust it anymore. All those fantasies, all those dreams, all those conclusions, all those things which you justify through thinking, thinking, thinking until you are sure that you are right, we stand back and see it with greater clarity. And when we see it with greater clarity, we can actually see through it. In other words, we don't trust it as a truth. Perhaps it was because of just my upbringing in good universities and just see where you had to great thinkers. One thing I did notice, all those great thinkers were just so stupid. And I couldn't believe that when you actually met Nobel laureates, you know, these were people just exceptional, the elite of the professors, and you could do things like that in a place like Cambridge. You met these people and had dinner with them. And then, you know, as a little student, that's what you're supposed to do, to try and expose, you know, these up-and-coming students with these great minds to see if there was, at the time I thought that what the point was, that you could get something from them. But actually the usual case was they got something from you. They got all their ideas, you know, from the rebellious students, because the rebellious students were, their brains were full of ideas. And after about 23 or 24, these research scientists, they'd lost their ideas. You get all the great insights, especially in science, when you're very young. But anyhow, one thing which I did notice, which actually shocked me, was that even though they were just incredibly powerful minds, they were just so stupid in life. They were having divorces and problems with their families, depression, and all sorts of other difficulties which they just could not understand. And what that really meant for me, that the power of thinking was not good enough. Now you started studying philosophers, and some of the philosophers, again, who thought very deeply about the nature of life, still there was no wisdom there. And of course the shock came, you know, when you started hanging around Buddhist teachers, especially monks, simple people who didn't think too much but knew so much, who could see more clearly. It was obvious that they had something which we call perspective. They could see deeper and beyond just what thought could give to you. And it was that which sort of encouraged me, that these people obviously had their act together. They were peaceful, they were wise. And of course, when you met someone like an Ajahn Chah, 4 years of school, primary school. He managed to graduate from grade 4, and that was it. And when you actually live with a person like that and just see how incredibly wise he is,
And this is not a wisdom which is of ideas or theory, it's just a wisdom of life. Just to see how he reacted and dealt with difficult things in life. I was just talking today about, I forget who it was who came today and was talking about Ajahn Chah introducing Bindabhata into the West, one of the first monks who actually went on alms round in the West. I'm not quite sure if that was true. Well, the first, but he's certainly one of the early ones, and certainly I remember the story, which was told to me in great detail and made us all sort of stand up, laugh, and typical Ajahn Chah, was when he was going on alms round in Hampstead in London. And just these Asians walking, well, an Asian and a couple of Westerners walking behind him, just walking on alms round through the streets of London, and no one really knew what they were. And there was this young kid, maybe 18, 19 year old, decided to test him out and threw a punch at Ajahn Chah. Actually threw a punch at this monk in the street, but just missed his nose, and then threw another one which missed his ear. And of course Ajahn Chah didn't know this guy was just testing him out, but Ajahn Chah was just so peaceful, he just carried on walking until this guy just gave up. The guy never meant to hit him, obviously, because he could have hit Ajahn Chah very easily, just to seeing what these monks are made of. And of course, Ajahn Chah afterwards, he went back to Thailand and he told us all, England's a really great place. We're going to send all our monks here to learn how to go on alms round and to test out to see whether they got fear or not. You know, those sorts of ways of dealing with difficult problems. Which, you know, what would you do if you were in that situation? What would you do, you know, if you were in a situation which was challenging your security, your life? I remember another occasion where there was this, it was a Westerner, this crazy Western Zen monk who came up to Ajahn Chah under his hut where we'd receive guests and kept on trying to enlighten Ajahn Chah. And he'd be speaking to him, and every now and again, this crazy Westerner would bang the floor really loud. Because apparently in the Zen tradition, that's supposed to make you enlightened. You know, some sort of shout or some bang, which is supposed to bring your mindfulness into this moment very sharply so you can see the Dhamma. And he was totally conceited. and all the time, Ajahn Chah was laughing, almost falling off his seat. He thought the funniest thing he'd ever seen. And just the way he reacted to all of these things was absolutely wonderful. And there was a fellow who was 4 years at school. He wasn't a great thinker, but he had perspective. And he had perspective that, you know, when people criticized him or when they praised him. And there were sometimes that he was in a situation where people were, you know, praising him and putting him on the high seats, and he would just... You know the old story of when the generals used to come and he spat on the general's hair, rubbed it in and said that was holy water. I mean, just that's crazy stuff to do. But he got away with it. And other times he was totally criticized. I remember this one occasion, a Thai professor came up to him and said, you know, you call yourself an arahat, you call yourself even an Aryan, and there you go chewing betel nut. Betel nut's a drug, it's an addiction, you know. Real monks don't chew betel nut. Real monks don't do this. It's an addiction. You know, if you're attached to betel nut, you must be attached to all these other things. And he went on like that. And Ajahn Chah was looking at him all the time. Never a moment of embarrassment. Never a moment of trying to defend himself. Just when the guy finished, he said, yeah, I've just been doing this for a long time. That's all he said. And so this guy just, you know, totally bamboozled simply because he thought he'd get a reaction out of Ajahn Chah. You're really shouting at him and tearing him to bits. And that's all Ajahn Chah said. And so this man just bowed and apologized. Now, you don't get to stages like that through thinking. You get to stages like that by seeing that, you know, there's all this praise and blame business. So what? It's a big deal. No matter who you are in this monastery, no matter how good you are or how stupid you are, sometimes you will get praise. And sometimes you'll get criticism. And you know, sometimes if you have thinking and if you have delusion, it will blow you around. You'll get upset when people sort of point out your faults. Ajahn Brahmi picks his nose. But, and then you feel, oh, at last someone really appreciates me when they praise you. But all of that praise and blame, you can look at it and say, what does that person know about me? How can they really judge and say who I am? It's hard enough for you to know who you are, let alone to know somebody else. When we have perspective, we don't praise or blame anybody. It's one of the great sayings of the Buddha. There's no being who is without praise, who is without blame in this world. So it's part of having a human existence, and even deva existence as well, to experience praise and blame. So when it comes to you, if you're a person who has no wisdom and who thinks a lot, you get very upset when people don't appreciate you. And all the hard work you do, and all the difficulties you have to work through, and all the extra time you spend looking after this monastery or looking after this place, and all the skill and the care and the love which you give into turning the compost. And if they don't appreciate you, but after a while, if that's how you think, you're just really going to get into a lot of suffering. And after a while, people get perspective. It's just words, that's all. It's just praise and blame. It's what's one of the eight loka dhammas, the eight worldly dhammas. If you have perspective on these things, what happens is you just let them go. You hear people praise you, and then you let it go. You hear people blame you, and then you let it go. And of course, I've had my fair share of praise and fair share of blame. I remember, oh, maybe I should get it out one day and show you, because I did keep it. Perhaps the worst blame I ever got was that time that I think Ajahn Yanadhamma was doing the Friday night talk at Nolamara. And he rang me the following morning. He said, something terrible happened last night. I said, what was that? He said, some kids went onto all the cars in the car park around Nolamara, putting in these posters on the windscreen. Ajahn Brahmi, they used my old lay name, Peter Betts, has committed adultery with my wife. That's what they said. It was amazing. And he said, what are you going to do about this? And I thought it was the funniest thing. And I just laughed my head off. And Ajahn Yana said, you know, he's always a very serious person. And he said, you've got to do something about this. Oh, I'll come in next week and see what's going on. So, you know, that's, I was actually quite touched by that because, you know, even the Buddha was criticized like that, so you know, I was in good company. So the next week I went in and said, look, you know, I don't do anything like that. We keep our rules, and if there's anyone's got any doubt, here's the committee, here's the president, the past president, so you can go and talk to them, and if you've got any information, please let us know. And so, of course, the whole thing just disappeared. And of course, I've experienced praise as well. But all that stuff, you know, if you haven't got perspective, that will really blow you around. And also, if you haven't got perspective, you will visit that on other monks in this monastery. Ajahn Chah, one of his great teachings, and he keep repeating this, maybe because we were Western monks and we were so critical, he would keep on saying that teaching, you only look at other monks maximum. You look at yourself 95% of the time. He said, that's maximum. Less than 5% is even better. So he said, don't go around looking at other people in the monastery and thinking what they're doing, how they're eating, how they're behaving. He said, because basically you can't know what they're up to, what they're doing. There's that story in the Dhammapada of Chakupala, who was walking meditation at night, stamping on all the ants who were on the meditation path. And the other monk said, that's just a cruel monk. He's destroyed so many animals. Until the Buddha said that he was blind. And the reason he became blind is he'd been meditating all night and not taking the medicine for his eyes. And he decided, okay, who needs eyes when you can get enlightened? So he was enlightened that night. and he killed so many animals. And they never realized what they were criticizing the person for. And there's so many cases like that. So basically, it's a waste of time trying to judge anybody else. The right perspective is to give people just metta, loving kindness, with this in their life, instead of being judgmental. And that perspective doesn't just carry on to people, it also carries on to things. Instead of like criticizing the food, or criticizing the talks, or criticizing sort of the fact that the water in the shower block is not as comfortable because the pressure isn't so much as it was before. Instead of criticizing these things or praising it when it comes back to normal again, you just say, this is life. We accept these things. We have a perspective to say, this is just another worldly dhamma. There's more than eight. Sometimes it's hot shower, sometimes it's cold shower. Somebody has just used up all the hot water because they've been doing their laundry and you have to have a cold shower. Yeah, so what? If you really complain about that and criticize it, you just come to me and I go telling you about the good old days. And then you go criticizing me for going on the good old days again. So in this way that we don't even criticize sort of the life which is around us. We can take this perspective of just this not fault-finding mind. It's such a beautiful level. We look upon our body. And sometimes your body has aches and pains. Sometimes it has diarrhea. Sometimes headaches. Sometimes it's sleepy and tired. And when we are critical, we have fault-finding minds. What happens? We get sort of negative towards the situation of our body. And that negativity translates into a depression. And that depression, I'm not talking about major depressions, I'm talking about the depression where you get bored, you get fed up, which means your meditation never takes off. It's important, if you wish to develop meditation, to build a foundation of this beautiful happiness which we call contentment, the santuti, just the contentment, the happiness, the joy of just being here. Now, the sort of happiness which is easily arisen in simple things, which you don't need great big things to make you happy, but just simple things, just like, you know, just looking at the beauty of the forest, or just the fact that you have some solitude, the fact that you are well fed, the fact that you are in a community which is peaceful and kind. Just those little simple reflections bring you this sense of peace and happiness and contentment, which creates the foundation for deep meditation. But whenever we get negative, whether it's to our body or to the life or whatever, this afternoon when I was walking meditation at the end of the path, there was a lot of cockatoos came through. I remember some people complaining about the noise of the cockatoos, screeching and making a racket. It's very easy to have a negative perception towards those cockatoos. When I was looking, they're just how beautiful it is, because I lived in many forests in Thailand. And even when the cockatoos are screeching at full voice, it's nowhere near as loud as the cicadas at night in some of the jungles I was staying in. And so it's very beautiful. So I've maybe developed over the years, instead of the fault-finding mind, this other perspective, the perception of the beautiful, to see the beauty in what one is experiencing, to a sense of gratitude. And that sense of gratitude, the gratitude to your kuti, the gratitude to being in a monastery which many, many people have spent such a long time building, the gratitude to all the people who come and feed us every day, the gratitude to your fellows in monastic life. I'm certainly grateful to each one of you who look after me, and I try and look after you. The gratitude for all the Anangarikas who come and look after the kitchen. And the gratitude to everybody and everything. With that great gratitude, then you have this beautiful, peaceful mind. The great grateful mind is a different way of looking at things. The fault-finding mind is another way of looking at things. And the point is, so often thinking follows the fault-finding mode. That's why it keeps on thinking. Once you find fault with things, the thinking gets stronger and stronger and stronger, and you find more faults, and you feel so justified that you are right, the monastery is wrong, that Ajahn Brahm sucks, the Sangha sucks, Buddhism sucks, whatever it is. It's very easy to get into that mode if you follow thinking, fueled by fault-finding. But a mind of gratitude, basically you don't have much to think about. If you follow thinking based on gratitude, it soon stops. It's a beautiful monastery. Then what? When there's faults, there's lots of business to be done. When there's gratitude, there's a sense of contentment. Gratitude leads to stopping, leads to completion, leads to ending. Fault finding just leads to more work, more things to be done, more business. Which is why the fault finding mind drives you crazy. The gratitude mind sends you to nirvana, to peace, to freedom. You have the choice there. It's just which attitude, which perspective you decide to choose. It's the same with, you know, the other Lokadharma of happiness and suffering, pain and pleasure, beauty and ugliness, tasty food and food which really disgusts you. And a lot of you would sometimes strive and plan and think of how can we get just the food which we like. Maybe you're having a trip home soon and already planning the menu. But all of this stuff, even when you plan the menu, even when you go to see your mum and she's more than happy to cook your favourite food, sometimes you imagine it first of all. And then with mindfulness you taste it. Look, I was in Thailand for 9 years and I never got fish and chips once. Not even chips. Not once in those 9 years. But after 7 years, 7 whole years in Thailand, I went to visit my mum. And I thought, my mother, actually, part of the vineyard, we can't ask for food for lay people, to lay people. And sometimes people have asked me, like, what can we get you? And I haven't said, because I know that's against the rules. But I remember once, I remember that the vineyard, and Ajahn Brahmani knows this, that you can always ask your parents for anything. You can ask them whatever you want, that's allowed. So when I went to see my mother in London, I thought, great, I'm going to get some chips for the very first time. And I think some of you know this story. It's a classic story. In English, this is working class. I didn't come from a rich family, just in a council flat that's government-subsidized housing. Because my father was very ill. He died when I was very young. Well, not very young, at 16. But a 58-year-old, that's very young. And in these working class homes, we used to have the chip pan. We used to have chips most nights. That's what we get attached to it, just conditioning, that's all. And that chip pan was never cleaned. When the oil ran out, you just added more. And that chip pan had been there for years. If you cleaned it, it took away the flavour and the taste. And I remember that. I've been in Thailand for 7 years. I remembered it was the same old chip pan, hadn't been washed or cleaned or whatever, just oil all over it, baked in, hard. And I remembered that, and I thought, oh great, that's the old chip pan. And as soon as I came in to the house, my mother looked at that chip pan and said, you know, I've been meaning to throw this away for a long time. And she took it and threw it in the bin, right in front of me. And I thought, that's unfair. Why are you doing that? After 7 years, I've been thinking about that. And right in front of me, right on the very day, this is the very first day I went to visit her. I actually did eventually get some chips on that visit from a Thai man. when I ever visit any Westerners, they'll say, oh, you've been in Thailand, you like rice and curry. And I say, look, I'm fed up with rice and curry. I've had that for 7 years. But what it taught me was, oh, this sort of thinking about pleasure and pain, no matter how much you try and control it, and how much you try and get what you want, it never works out. But I do remember also the time I did, when I came back here, and one day, Najan Jaka was, yeah, but he was pretty tough. It was one day I had to go to a funeral service. And when on the way back, there was no way I can get back to the monastery for the lunch. So he said, just get yourself something on the way back. So I managed to time it just right to get to Byford Fish and Chip Shop. It's the first time you got real fish and chips, proper fish and chips from a fish and chip shop. And as soon as I ate it, it was just so different than my fantasies. The thoughts and the dreams of sensory pleasures and the actuality doesn't match. And that actually shocked me. I was mindful enough, aware enough, because, you know, I've been planning this for a long time, and now here it was, so you're in the moment. I wasn't going to waste this. I was in the moment, and when I tasted those things, it wasn't exactly how I imagined it would be. And that shocked me. It showed me the difference between the thoughts and reality, between the imagination and mindful experience. And that took away so much of that lust and craving and desire. And I realized that's the same with all of these things. It's just pleasure and pain, that's all, just happiness and suffering. The reality is very simple. But through thought and wrong perspective, we build up this huge scenario around these qualities. We make a world of them. And we are imprisoned by that world. If we know things as they truly are, it's just pleasure, it's just pain, that's all. It goes so quickly. And no matter what your favorite food is, it just lasts a moment in your mouth and it disappears. But the thought about it lasts for a long period of time. The experience is just momentary. That's why the Buddha, he gave this wonderful simile for Vedana, for pleasure and pain. It's sort of like a drop of rain in a puddle. You see drops of rain in a puddle. We have plenty of rain in the last, two or three months. So you could contemplate Vedana. You just watch it, plops, and it's gone in a fraction of a second. He said, that's what this sensory experience is like. It rises and falls almost immediately. And so the pleasure, the pain, it just disappears so quickly. It's wonderful to know that. Sometimes people say, it's okay if the pain disappears quickly, can't the pleasure last a bit longer? But you see that the both are together there. And just as pain is just momentary, so is pleasure. And the main thing about that is to know it's just part of nature, it is loka dhamma, and it can't be controlled, no more than praise and blame can be controlled. You may work very, very hard to be popular, to try and do what other people like, and still they put you down and blame you. You may bust your ass trying to please people, and still they don't appreciate you. That's life. So the answer to that is stop busting your ass. Because just trying to please other people is a waste of time. Because trying to search for praise and to avoid blame, you can't do that. Trying to search for pleasure is the same, and avoid pain. You just can't do that. It's one of the great things when you really focus and contemplate, that loka dhamma, and know how much it's out of control. As I was talking last week, just when you try and control things, it's actually not quite what I said last week. We just change one type of suffering for another. Usually when you try and change things, the suffering gets worse. And you're much better where you were before. This is one of the problems. Sometimes you do that when you're meditating. Sometimes you're in a bit of pain and you move and it's worse. Happened to me a lot when I had the back pain. And afterwards I said, oh, this is good enough. Yeah, it hurts, but No, it's just pain, that's all. It'll disappear. It's one of the great things which I know about pain. No matter how bad it gets, it won't last. It's a great thing to know that, because it means you can endure. Physical pain is temporary, no matter how bad it is. And knowing it's temporary is the proverbial light at the end of the tunnel, which means you can just endure for a little bit more. It's going to go. You can always just go another round. Apparently, Peter Sale told me that Rocky said that in some movie. I can always go another round. And he said that was the most wise Buddhist teaching he'd ever had. But when you say that, it means you can endure because you know it's going to end. You know it's going to not last. And that's one of the great things about that, which means one lets things be. And when you do let things be, instead of controlling them and fighting them, the reason why it gets worse when you try and change things is because you're fighting rather than just going along with things. Life has its happiness and suffering, and you can't control that. But when you fight and try and mess around with it, you add to the suffering of life, which is why in Buddhism we call that double dukkha. It's just the happiness and suffering of the world, of the body, of hearing. When you don't like what you're hearing, you don't like what you're seeing, you don't like what you're tasting, you don't like anything when you're sort of suffering. But if we can just make peace with that, be kind, be gentle, as I keep on saying. And if you're fed up with me keeping on saying, make peace, be kind, be gentle, then see, you're reacting to that. You're making it much worse. So if you're bored with me keeping on saying, make peace, be kind, be gentle, you know what you should do? Make peace, be kind, be gentle with me saying, make peace, be kind, be gentle. Otherwise, you know what you do to yourself? You're just making yourself more tense, creating suffering for yourself. So when we realize these things are loka dhammas, now worldly dhammas mean they're part and parcel of existence. You can't do anything about them. You're stuck with them. All you can really do is your attitude towards them. You can fight a battle which you can never win. You can find fault with them, or you can just be content and let things be. It's being content and letting things be with those loka dhammas, with things which you can't change. That was a wonderful thing which I learned in Thailand. You were out of control. You didn't know what to expect. Ajahn Chah would always teach you, mind there, which is uncertain, uncertain, uncertain. So you come to a talk like this, and you didn't know how long it was going to last for. There was no such thing as here when you know I'm only going to speak for about 45 minutes, an hour, maybe an hour and 10 minutes at most. Sometimes you come out for the evening talk and you wouldn't go back to your hut until just before Bindabhata. You'd be talking all night. You weren't even allowed to go to the toilet. Sometimes it was like that, and it wasn't an interesting talk either. You were bored out of your skull. Sometimes it would be better if you didn't understand Thai. And that was what he did that on purpose. He called it Toraman, which is a Thai word for torture, but we realized after a while that Ajahn Chah wasn't torturing us. That was just life, it was uncertain. But I was torturing myself if I kept on saying, when is Ajahn Chah going to finish? That stupid monk, doesn't he know I'm tired? Doesn't he know that according to medicine you need at least 8 hours sleep at night? Doesn't he know that I've got a lot of things to do in the morning? I didn't become a monk like this. I want to meditate in my own heart, whatever you're saying like that. You're just torturing yourself. And I learned from those experiences that so much of the pain of life, actually the most important part of it, is self-torture. And those sorts of insights really helped understand what goes on in a monastery. That how we may have one of the most beautiful, well-set-up monasteries in the Western world, and how we can have all this great support and all this time for ourselves, and all these resources, thousands of talks. If you don't like my talks, you can go to the library and get an iPod with Lungtang Mahabua's talks, Ajahn Chah's talks, Ajahn Sumedho's talks. There's so many talks, you can just put them in your ears and just listen to talks all day for the whole rains retreat. Even though there's so many resources, we still torture ourselves. And that's a very amazing thing to realize. It's just, I don't want this. I want to go somewhere else. I just don't want to be here. And it's that sort of craving, that fault-finding, negative, whiny mind, which always finds faults in things. Just like you find faults in other people, you find faults in this moment. That is what Ajahn Chah was trying to point out to us when we're having all these long talks. That's what he was trying to say. That's the Dharma right there. Not in the sort of the words he was saying and all these great inspiring sort of anecdotes he would say, or these one-liners which people would remember and write down in books. But it was actually being there and being told that this is how you react to life. That was the problem, and that's where the Dhamma lies. And all the thinking and the theory, yeah, it's interesting and it sort of can get you close, but that's not what the Dhamma is. What the Dhamma is how you're reacting to this moment right now. What are you doing with this? You know, if this moment, this talk, you know, this hall, the heat, the cold, the sickness, you know, the feelings in the body, you know, your plans for your future, the memories of your past, what are you dealing with that? Because most of these things, as I call them, this is old karmas come to fruition right in this moment, right now. This is the result of karma. It's here. The pain, the boredom, whatever it is, it's here, and you deserved it. Of course you deserved it, it's all cause and effect. You made this moment happen, so don't blame anybody else. The point is, what are you doing with this? What karma are you making now with this present moment? And that idea of the law of karma really fascinated me and just showed me just it's what we're doing with things right now, our relationship, our perspective with this moment. And that's why I, many other monks, we develop this, just make peace, be calm, be gentle with this moment. Make good karma with what you're experiencing, whatever it happens to be. Because life sometimes is difficult, sometimes things go wrong, sometimes trees fall on roofs, sometimes workers don't turn up. Sometimes bamboo just swells. Sometimes, you know, the food isn't nice. Sometimes, you know, you make plans and you can't do it. Sometimes people don't do what they said. Welcome to life. When these things happen, what I was taught, how the Dharma works, is how am I going to react to that? What am I doing with this? Praise, blame, happiness, suffering. Things work out as you expected, you're disappointed. What are we doing with this? And it's that way of reacting. That's where the work is. That's where the training is. That's where the vinaya lies. That's where the core what, the monastic etiquette is, in how you are reacting to this moment right now. And this is the only place where we do have a choice. When I say you can't control things, when I say do nothing, yes, but... It's really what I'm saying is, how are you reacting to this moment? What are you doing with this? This is where the action lies. This is where the Eightfold Path lives. In how you react to this moment, no matter what it happens to be. This is the only place where you do have any power, any control. You can actually do something. Which is why you watch this moment. And when you're meditating, you're sitting, you're walking, you're under the shower, you're sitting on the loo, you're having your lunch. Whatever's happening, what are you doing with this moment? That is called mindfulness. It's called sampajanya, mindfulness and clear comprehension. And the Dharma teaches you, make peace, be kind, be gentle. That's what I mean by not doing something. It's doing peace, it's doing kindness, it's doing gentleness, if you like. It's doing investigation. As I said last week, we learn from these moments. We don't try and change them. We don't fight them. We're not warriors. We're researchers, investigating this moment, learning from it. And it's from that learning from things we see that Yang Kinchi Samudaya Dhammang, Sabbantang Nirodha Dhammanti, this moment, it rises because of causes. And when those causes go, this moment will go. And that's a wonderful thing to know. The emotions of being fed up, it will pass. Boredom, It will pass. Euphoria and bliss, it passes. You know these things, this moment, right now, has had its course and has to pass away again. And that reason, when you understand that, you have the right perspective to life. These come from their causes, they just disappear again. So your job is just to let them go and not fight them, not to make more suffering in life. And that's the thing which you are in charge of. Now you are fortunate to have human births. You are fortunate to have come to Buddhism. You don't mind saying that. You are fortunate to be in a monastery which is well supported, which has facilities, with all the Dharma is there for you. You are fortunate. So what are you going to do about it? That's your choice. That's your karma. That's what you have to live with. But if you see the Dharma, you see that all these things which arise pass away, no matter what you do. So after a while you just let them flow. You have success, you have failure. Things go well, things don't go well. You have great meditation, not so great meditation. You realize it is par for the course, and your job is just to stand back and just watch these things come and go. Just like the old idea of the hermit on the mountains. You know that you're on a mountain, and for 1 year that it's not there anymore. We had the small A-frame which we tore down last year, and we built the hut, I think, which Fen Ekagata's in right now. I remember staying there because I built that A-frame hut. It was the second hut on this monastery. The big A-frame was where Ajahn Jagro stayed. And after moving from under a tree to a tent to the water tank hut, which was flooded with water, then I finally got my own decent kuti, which was a small A-frame. I remember sometimes on a weekend you'd meditate there, up in the apex, and you could look out onto Southwest Highway. And on a Friday night you see all the headlights of the cars going south. And then a couple of days later you'd be sitting up there meditating, and you open your eyes and all the headlights were going north. Same cars. And you said, just what a waste of time. And they went south, now they go north again. They ended up where they were. They should have stayed put and saved some money on gas. And you just see that. That just gave me the, just a simile, that all these things, all this coming and going, now you're happy, now you're sad, now you're inspired, now you're depressed, now you're sort of sick, now you're healthy. Just all this coming and going business, the rise and fall of samsara. And I use that as a perspective. And there I am sitting on this mountain. So just watching these cars come, watching these cars go. But I'm sitting still. I'm just staying put. I'm just staying put in this silence, in this peace, in this freedom of being a monk who doesn't have to go anywhere. You can just sit and watch other people go. And I try to keep that perspective even when I go travelling. I kept that perspective by noticing that I'm not moving, the plane is moving, the car is moving, but I'm sitting still. And if you can do that, sit still when you're travelling, it means you're not going to the destination, you're not lingering where you came from, you're just right there in the moment where you are. And you try and practice that way. Whenever you're going on a journey, you're going to the dentist, or as I was asking a couple of people to volunteer to go to the Cambodian Dharma on Saturday, when you're in that car, be there, rather than be at the destination or be back at the monastery. Be where you are, be in the moment. And that's a way we can practice. It's how we are reacting and how we are using the experiences which are presented to us in monastic life. And if you can be just content on the journey. I remember going to those Cambodian Dharanas. This is Cambodian Dharana, making merit for the dead. This is their time, I think you may have heard me say during one of the meals, that this is their time when they're making merit for their dead. They have 2 weeks when their dead come out of the hell or whatever, they can receive offerings. This is their 2 weeks, so they like to make lots of merit at this time. Whether you believe that or not, it's up to you. But I remember going to some of these Cambodian dharanas and just so much food was put in my bowl and it was just a mess. It would make even the strongest stomach sort of get stomach ache afterwards. And used to go every year, here we go, stomach ache again. I used to get stomach ache almost every time. I think they're much better now, apparently. So I'm just talking, you know, about the good old days. And just to wreck my stomach, but it was just what you had to do. And so when you were travelling, you just accepted it, made peace with it. You can't stop it, you can't do anything about it, so just don't make it worse. And actually, I just got, instead of actually knowing I was getting a stomach, I got so much joy and inspiration about, you know, these Cambodians. They've gone through so much suffering, you know, during the sort of Pol Pot years. And just even, you know, the man who came today, you know, the old man, Ajahn Lim, he was a monk before, that's what we called him Ajahn. He was forced by the Khmer Rouge to disrobe or take a bullet. And he decided to sort of disrobe rather than get shot. And it's just the amount of suffering those people have gone through. It's just immense. Something which I can never appreciate or experience, or just I can't get my head around it because I haven't had that experience. But they just get on with their lives. They learn how to make peace with it and accept it rather than fighting it. And it's the same that when I go to those dharanas, when I've gone to them, you think, gee, that I've only got a stomach ache for, you know, a couple of hours. And what these people have been through is just 1,000,000,000 times like that. I need to help them. So you have positive attitudes like that. So this is one wonderful way of your perspective on what you're experiencing. Yeah, you can get upset and think, what do I have to do this for? But have a bit of compassion. Remember, make peace, be kind, be gentle. And sometimes that people think that Theravada Buddhism is not compassionate, but you really help other people. You know, that's one of the reasons why I'm an abbot, so I can help more people. And it's not just sacrificing sort of your practice. That's why sometimes people think it's an either or. Either you've got to sit in your hut and just meditate all day to get enlightened, and if you sort of go out and sort of go to dharanas and help people, it's going to wreck your meditation. And my own experience was opposite. I couldn't understand why at first. There were other monks over there in Thailand who did nothing for anybody. They managed to have all the support, staying in the forests, in the jungles, looking after themselves. And then I thought, these guys, they must be so advanced in their meditation. Must get, you know, far more jhanas than I get. And then when after the years, when I talked with them, I was just surprised that my meditation was far better than theirs. I think, gee, but I've been working so hard, helping so many people. Because even when I was in Thailand, I did a lot of work at Wat Nanachat. And after a while, you know, it took me a while to understand why. You know, you realized it wasn't whether you're working or not working. It was your attitude towards all of that. How you dealt with it. And for me, just the work, helping, serving, was an inspiration. I could help people being a monk. Even as a junior monk, when it says in the suttas, you are a field of merit. Now, much more so than giving food to a lay person, even a hungry lay person, giving food to a monk is a field of merit, said the Buddha. What the heck did that mean? You know, you're being an inspiration for people. They wanted to support you because they admired what you were doing and why you were doing it, and getting a sangha going, a monastery going. And you were part of that. And so serving that gave us huge source of inspiration. Only later on, when you started studying Buddhism, you see that written down there very clearly. It's Chaganusati, where you reflect upon all of your generosity, your giving, your sacrifice. And that's one of the 40 kamatanas, the 40 subjects of meditation. You reflect upon that. All you anagarikas, how hard you've slaved in the kitchen. All you people who've looked after the cars, just how much you've worked trying to sort of service and get those cars working. And all the people who've washed up. All the people who have cut down the trees when they fall on the patio, who've looked after the water, who've turned the compost, who've looked after the workshop. You know, who've done all the secretary work. You know, all these people who've worked so hard. You've sacrificed so much. And you reflect upon that. You reflect and reflect and reflect until you start feeling really good about yourself. You think, wow, I did that. Wow, that is good karma. And I know I do that. And it gets a huge amount of energy. So it's, you do these things, it's how you make use of them. Your perspective on these. That's actually, you can look upon that and get this critical mind, go into sort of fault finding. I didn't become a monk to turn compost. I didn't become an anagarika to slave in the kitchen. I didn't become sort of a novice to sort of cut down trees. I didn't do this to do that. You can very easily get into that sort of mind. That's your choice. That's where you have a choice. That's where you have, in a sense, control. You can actually control and create suffering for yourself. Or you can create these positive attitudes. Another perspective. To say, what a wonderful thing this is. And create this incredible peace and happiness and joy. And that's the way of Dhamma. Now, the way of Dhamma is a way of peace, a way of freedom. This is actually how you get out of that prison cell, how you open the windows and create this beautiful sense of joy and happiness. Sure, you can judge your meditation. I've been meditating for so long, I'm getting nowhere. Oh, this monastery, it's just too Thai. You can say, oh, it's just too traditional. We should chant all this sort of the Sangha Karma in English. We should stop wearing these stupid robes and wear brown trousers and... Oh no, all this shaving our eyebrows, for goodness sake. I mean, that's stupid. We should have eyebrows. What's wrong with having eyebrows? And all this sort of stuff which can be very, very critical. That's one way of looking at things. But the other way is a more peaceful way. It's a more joyful way. A way of gratitude for our tradition. A way of making use of what we have to experience. That's where we have the choice. Not so whether we should shave our eyebrows or not, but just how we relate to that, how we react to that, and how we could just make peace and be kind, be gentle with our tradition. And how that way of looking at things, that way of being grateful, that positivity, how that can create this enormous sense of peace. And with that sense of peace, we look at sort of our meditation, we look at our life, and we can actually let go of this ill will and craving. We can actually escape from the prison. We find that that prison is made of our stupid reactions, the way we try and control life in a stupid way. And that's with the walls and the bars of our prison. I've often said that in the prison, in the simile, will, this thing which we call our choice, is our prison guard. When that is let go of, we just make peace, we're kind, we're gentle, we're still, we're calm, we're positive, no fault finding, we're grateful. That opens the door of the jail. And we can just walk out. We can be free. And we have had the moments of freedom in our life. You know, you all have enough wisdom to know what it's like. Just know when you fight and when you make peace. Sometimes people used to ask, it must be so tough living as a monk in a monastery. And it's not tough, because you have more freedom here. And this is the freedom born of contentment. When you're happy to be here, no matter where that happens to be, when you are content, that's where you find freedom. You all know the simile of the prison and the monastery. What's the difference between freedom and being in a prison? It's whether you want to be here or whether you want to be somewhere else. It's a wonderful teaching, so simple. Right now, do you want to be here or do you want to be back in your hut? Right now, do you want to be in a Wednesday evening? You can't wait till the weekend. Right now, where do you want to be? Here or somewhere else? If you want to be somewhere else, that's called dukkha. If you want to be here, that's called freedom. It's such a deep teaching. Because so much of my life I look at it and I always want to be somewhere else. I want to finish the task. I want to finish the retreat center. I want to get all the bamboo floor all straight again. You know, I just want to get all the monks happy. I want to pay off all the debts. I just want to get all the monks enlightened. I want to get the whole Buddhist society enlightened. That's wanting to be somewhere else. Little committee making all its little mistakes, having all their silly ideas. You can love them for that. So if you want to try and make them different, then I want to be somewhere else. That's where the suffering lies. You see that when people even travel, they can't wait to get to the destination. It's strange, actually, if I go on aircraft such a lot. You see that as soon as a boarding call is made, people just rush to get onto the aircraft. They can't wait to get on board. And as soon as they land, they can't wait to get out again. Crazy, where do you want to be? Or do you want to be somewhere else? When they're in the terminal, they want to be on board. When on board, they want to get out. Very few people really want to be here with what's happening in life. That's why very few people are content. So a lot of times, if ever you're suffering in meditation, in your heart, in life, when you may be old and sick in a hospital bed, about to die, please remember that suffering is only what you're making it. If you want to be somewhere else, that's called the fault-finding critical mind. If you want to be here, that's freedom. People are praising you. People are criticizing you, just want to get somewhere else. That's called suffering. If you're just happy to be here, at peace with things, content, easily satisfied, not demanding in nature, then you know the path of freedom. And you can use that, please use that in your meditation. When you're walking on the path, ask yourself, are you happy to be here in this moment, right now? If you're not, that's where you're causing suffering. As you're walking on your path, if you say, I'm just happy to be here, it's not the best, it's cold, I've got a headache, I'm restless, I'm tired, but I'm happy to be here. Then you find you're free. And you find that freedom just takes you so deep. You're sitting there, bad back, like let's say during my retreat, his back is quite good now. Bad back, tired, but you're just happy to be here. Then the mind gets still so quickly. It's a great trick. And you don't understand how powerful that happens to be. You know, in Open the Door of the Heart, I mentioned the story of my toothache. It's terrible, terrible pain. Just couldn't, no way you can sleep. Couldn't even sit still in meditation. Fighting it. Until just one moment I said, I'm not fighting anymore, I'm going to let it be. And I really was just content to be there with this scorching pain. And that's when experience, which has happened many times, the pain vanished. In a moment, not even a second, less than a second, replaced by bliss. It's a great, actually, way to get rid of pain, much better than Panadol or anesthetic. Just change the attitude. Change the perspective. Just be happy to be here. And all the difficulty faded. If you have more experiences like that, you'll find this a trick of monastic life, what we're here for. While we're practicing, you know, the path of letting go, the path of making peace, the path of contentment, you know, the path of freedom. When you struggle, trying to control happiness and suffering, trying to control praise and blame, trying to make it just so nice for yourself. You just go around samsara time and time again, never finding any place of satisfaction. The reason we have a monastery is because in a monastery, contentment is praised. Contentment, letting things be, is talked about. This is what is marketed in a monastery. Out there in the world, contentment is not marketed at all. It's consume more, get more, do more, keep on the move. You have holidays, you've got to go somewhere else. Monday, you've got to go to work. Always moving, always pushed, always on the run. And never allowed to be content. People are always planning something else. We're always going to the next destination. It's in a monastery. This is a place where contentment is praised. Where sort of peace is what we're supposed to be generating. We're not supposed to be making more, consuming more, going places. We're supposed to be finishing things rather than starting things. This is why here is where we stand our ground. This is where we practice contentment. This is where we say, this moment is good enough. This breath is good enough. This nimitta is good enough. Even if it's just an ordinary one. This is good enough. Contentment. Rather than praise and blame. Rather than trying to control suffering and happiness. We develop the opposite. Making peace. Being kind. Being gentle. Contentment. Freedom. Letting go. And you just fall into these deep states of peace and bliss. This is where you understand the Dhamma. It's not trying to change the moment, it's understanding it and knowing what liberation means. You can't change the world, but you can liberate yourself by being at peace. So that's an attitude, it's a perspective. That's what the Dhamma is. How we relate to whatever we're experiencing in this moment. So that's a talk this evening.
Sukhati Pano.